and thanks for listening. Today we have with us Dr. Cassandra Beepton, who works along with Marilyn Schlitz at Noetic Sciences. How are you today, Cassie?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Thanks for being with us today. So you, I've read over your paper, and it's really interesting. I can't believe somebody's finally doing that. But before we get into it, why don't you just tell us a little bit about you? You've got a lot of interesting things around what you're doing.
Well, I'm a clinical psychologist, and I was trained to be a psychotherapist. And along the way, I became very interested in research, because partly because it had the potential to deal with problems sort of on a mass level as opposed to seeing one person at a time. And so I still find both very valuable. But I've had a long-standing interest in spirituality and spiritual practice as it might relate to improving health and well-being, particularly in the realms of the ways people deal with their emotions and their relationships with other people, and in the area of addictions. So I work in two different places. One is California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco, where we do testing of mindfulness-based approaches for people who are dealing with addictions. Mm-hmm. And we also use mindfulness-based approaches, including meditation and yoga, for pregnant women and new moms, in the hopes that it might help people deal with, that it might improve mood and reduce stress during pregnancy and potentially reduce the incidence of postpartum depression. And then at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, we do work on looking at how spiritual transformation happens across people and across various spiritual, religious, and modern transformative movements.
Well, I know that that's what we're going to focus on tonight, but if we have a little bit of time at the end of the interview, I'd love for you to talk about some of your addiction work and maybe some things that people can do at home to help themselves.
Sure.
We have a little bit of time. So tell me, how did this project come about? I mean, most people don't recognize epiphanies or spiritual enlightenment unless they've experienced it themselves. They don't usually believe it when somebody else tells them that it happened. Have you had that happen in your life?
Well, actually, the way this program came about in the very beginning was that there was a man who is has been our primary donor and who was the founder of the project, who had his own epiphany, and he was at a place called Esalen here on the West Coast in Big Sur, and he was someone who's a businessman and a very successful businessman, but he was interested in just starting to explore, you know, if there's something more to life, if there was something that he might be missing. And so at one of these workshops at Esalen, he went out onto the balcony and had an experience where he was just completely overwhelmed with the experience of feeling interconnected with all of life, feeling kind of fused with everything he was seeing, and just felt a deep, deep sense of profound gratitude and awe mm-hmm. at the beauty of existence. And it changed him forever. And at this point, although he was doing great work in the business world before, now he's very much a leader in many, many altruistic activities, and he uses his wealth to support, for example, small business loans to developing countries and microloans and things like that. And so mm-hmm. he came to us and said, I want to understand more about what happened to me, and I want to see if we can find out ways that we can maybe help it happen for other people.
And that's interesting. Did you find out that that it can be made to happen?
Well, I don't know about making it happen, but we have identified some of the characteristics that can trigger a transformative experience. And so, you know, starting off by saying that there are extraordinary experiences that I think everyone has from time to time. There are mm-hmm. experiences that are peak experiences or aha moments or amazing things or things that are hard to understand but seem very real. The difference between those and a transformative experience is that, for some reason, transformative experiences actually result in a long-lasting mm-hmm. change in someone's way of relating to the world and their sense of self and the way that, their way of being.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the triggers of these transformative experiences are, first of all, I would say the number one trigger, which is maybe surprising, but probably not surprising to many people, is an experience of deep suffering or an experience of loss or a near-death experience. Those are things, it could be loss of a loved one, or it could be something, a brush with death or an illness or just a very deep, dark night of the soul.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course,
that's exactly what happened to me with a deep, dark night of the soul. In fact, I was doing an interview with William Rowell about that, and he said almost everybody that he had interviewed and everybody that I know that's had an experience like that has had to go through a, really hit bottom.
Yeah. Well, what we find in our research is that that is a common predictor, but that some people also have these kinds of experiences in response to a positive experience or a not that the painful ones don't end up being positive, but an experience of awe or beauty or, sometimes the birth of a child or just being in nature, witnessing something amazing can also be a transformative moment. So I don't think it always requires that. But what we found about the transformative process is that even if that kind of experience doesn't trigger a transformative moment, almost everyone has to walk through some challenge and some darkness on their journey.
Do you find that those profound spiritual epiphanies, those really instantaneous changes come, usually follow a dark night of the soul, or does it matter? Or do some of them just gradually progress up?
Well, we asked this question. I can back up and talk a little bit about how we did the study. First of all, what we did was we collected many people's experiences of their own transformative moments, and we tried to look and see if there were commonalities across those experiences in terms of what triggered them and what happened afterward, and that was some of the preliminary work that was done by Marilyn Schlitz and Moira Killoran and Rhea White before I came to Noetic Sciences. And then when I came, what we started to do was say, well, we know that there are some commonalities across individuals. Are there commonalities across the various spiritual traditions and the way people frame the transformative process? And so we have interviewed now about 50 masters, teachers, and scholars from a variety of spiritual traditions, religions, and modern transformative movements. And we've looked for those commonalities. And so as we've looked across those traditions, that's kind of what I'll tell you tonight comes out of that work. And one of the questions we asked those teachers was, what do you think about this idea that there can be a very sudden transformation? I don't know if you've ever read the book by William Miller and Janet C. DeBaca called Quantum Change.
But
that's that's a book I'd recommend to you and your listeners. And they did a study kind of similar to ours, except for they only interviewed people who had had these sudden, instantaneous sort of lightning bolt transformation experiences.
Mm-hmm.
What we learned from our research is that while some people have those experiences, many, many people have a series of small epiphanies.
Mm-hmm.
And even when someone has a big lightning bolt experience that changes their life, there's a lot of integration work that has to happen afterwards. And then what you find is there's often a lot of preparation leading up to it. So maybe not conscious, but there are things that have happened on the way up to it that kind of prime one to have that experience and to not only have it, but to have it translate into a positive change. Because, of course, many people go through a very distressing experience and it's traumatic. It's not life-changing in a positive way.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of things for the listeners did you find that led up to it so that they might spot that in their own lives?
Well, I would say, again, this experience of suffering is one, because what it does, what it can do is it can, although, it can be very painful, it can also be very disorienting for someone's entire life to change. For example, we are doing work right now with folks at a local homeless shelter, and so these are people who are going through a real dark night of the soul, and their lives have been completely thrown into the air, and they're very disoriented, and although we wouldn't wish this on anyone, there's also this opportunity to reorient oneself in a new way. And so I think, you know, it sounds a little bit cliche or a little bit trite, but when someone's in an experience of deep suffering, it's to see that crisis also as an opportunity and to say, you know, what am I to learn from this? And so that approaching experience with a sense of curiosity is one thing that differentiated people who had experiences and they ended up being transformative from people who couldn't, you know, really get something out of an experience that they were having.
Do the people that haven't been what we call so-called seekers a little bit, do they understand what you're trying to tell them, that if they could just change their perspective, it could change the way it is?
Well, I think this is something that's not intellectually understandable in a certain sense. I mean, although we're trying to bring the lens of science and research to this topic, there's a, I don't know, I don't think I'd call it mysterious, because I think it's actually something that's quite common.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it has to be directly experienced. And so there is an extent to which someone's openness to experience will kind of, I don't know, lay the groundwork or set the conditions for a transformative experience to take place. That's not always true. I mean, we've all heard about these experiences where someone was, you know, by all accounts completely not interested in any kind of change and had a lightning bolt change experience. But I think, in general, bringing a sense of openness and curiosity is a real asset to being able to utilize these experiences for all they're worth.
Well, I think it would probably be, for my own self anyway, I wasn't seeking when it happened to me. I was caught up in my career, but I had previously been a seeker, and having had the information that I had gotten from being a seeker probably made it more acceptable to me.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I actually thought I was going crazy.
Well, that's one of the
and people
main...
thought that about me too.
Absolutely, and I work with someone named David Lukoff, who's done a lot of work in the realm of what he calls spiritual emergence or spiritual emergency. And you know, it's certainly true that there are a lot of elements of this process that can look a lot like a psychiatric problem.
Yeah,
it really can, and it can feel that way. And so,
it changes who you are instantly.
Yeah, yeah. And so one of the things we found in our research really helps people to get the most out of these experiences is to have a language for what's happened to them and a context for what's happened to them and a community to whom they can talk to about it.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone doesn't even have words for something that happened, it's really hard for them to bring it back into their everyday life. And if they don't have a community of folks that kind of understand what they're talking about and that they can share their experience with and hear the experiences of others, it can be very difficult and very isolating.
Because I actually, when it happened to me, I'd grown up a fundamental Baptist, and so I kept saying to myself, did the devil do this to me? And I actually checked in to one of those psychological places, and that they're not supportive of this kind of thing. They kind of make you think like you're going crazy. They tell you that you're having racing thoughts and that you're becoming psychotic, but they're not supportive of it at all. But it is real, and it really happens.
Well, there's a lot of work being done now. You know, there was in psychology and psychiatry for a while there was a big movement for cultural competence, so that all the psychologists and psychiatrists recognized that, well, we don't really know enough about how to work with other cultures, and so it became an ethic in the field that you had to teach yourself how to understand elements of other cultures. And now there's a movement to introduce a spiritual competency, so that even if a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist is not spiritual themselves,
mm-hmm.
they ethically need to educate themselves about the kinds of spiritual experiences that can mimic a psychiatric problem, but not necessarily be a psychiatric problem.
Oh, that's really great that that's happening. It really is. So how is Western medicine or the scientists in the Western world accepting what you're doing?
Well, I mean, I think that's one strength of science, is that when you, for lack of a better way of saying it, when you play by the rules, when you generate hypotheses and you come up with methods of testing your hypotheses and you replicate your work You're doing the same kind of science that you're doing on things that are more in the physical realm. And so that's what we're trying to do, is bring a rigorous scientific lens to this area that is difficult to study just because it's difficult to define and it's hard to measure some of these constructs. But my bias is that it's not any more difficult than some of the most vexing medical problems that we have faced in the past 10, 20, 30 years. And so it's really about our society putting a premium or a high value on cultivation of these kinds of capacities. And I think it's starting to happen. I was reading, there was a scholar about a century ago who was writing about the study of love and promoting the idea that love should be studied, and said, you know, studies of how we can bring greater love into our world are akin to, you know, bringing fire. I mean, it's really, at this point in our society and in our global society, so many of our problems are due to intolerance and the limits of human, you know, the limits of how humans can cooperate and collaborate, due to an inability to forgive, an inability to be humble, inability to have gratitude. So all of these things are actually, you know, while they kind of seem a little bit airy-fairy, or they may seem like, well, you know, let's spend all of our time doing things in the physical world first and then we'll attend to those things, we think that these are actually essential living capacities that require and deserve just as much scientific attention as other things.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when somebody experiences love, if you're giving, like if you're in the middle of a heated argument and you suddenly change that and you start behaving with agape towards that person, something happens. Your heart rate changes. Your skin temperature changes. The dilation of your eyes changes. And that person picks it up and it changes their behavior back. I mean, almost in an instant, if you've ever noticed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think that's a very interesting, a lot of science and health research up until now has been very much focused on the individual person and what's happening inside of them and inside of their bodies. But we're coming into an age now in the 21st century where we need to start looking at what's happening between people.
Mm-hmm.
And so our subject of scientific investigation is no longer just individual, but it's pairs of people, it's groups of people, it's societies. And it's these kinds of capacities, I think, what Mike McCullough is a researcher in Miami who calls them, and maybe other people have called them, other regarding virtues, such as gratitude and humility and love.
Interesting. Now, when you were interviewing all these people, one of the things that as a teacher, when I spot somebody that's in the dark night of the soul or that has constant chaos going on in their life, a lot of times they'll have like sickness coming and going, depression coming and going, tumors, cancers coming and going. And sure enough, if you watch long enough, an epiphany will happen with them. Did you notice that with these people?
Well, not exactly in that sense. I mean, I think there are certainly things that are waiting to be recognized and that sort of raise the red flags every now and then to say, okay, are you ready to recognize yet? Are you ready to recognize yet? And
yeah.
Those can come through our behaviors, and they may be manifested in illnesses that are stress-related and things of that nature. And I guess what I'll say is that, you know, there seemed to be a feeling, and we're kind of back to that preparation discussion, that these kinds of experiences and this kind of transformation, in a sense, is kind of knocking on the door all the time. The experiences that we have that are extraordinary are more because we recognize them to be extraordinary, not because they're not happening all the time.
Right, right. What do you believe to be the purpose of an epiphany shift like that?
Well, I think there's a lot of speculation about that. I mean, we interviewed a spiritual teacher named Andrew Cohen, who I found very interesting, and he talks about the evolution of consciousness. He sort of has a radical idea about it, and he says he thinks it's humanity or consciousness itself trying to evolve, trying to move forward. I think, you know, all the way back to Maslow, there is a human need to reach our full potential, and there are needs for love and affiliation and for there are drives for coming together and cooperation and collaboration, and there's a lot of recent research that is supporting this idea, although we focused a lot up until now on finding out about illnesses and why people break down and why sickness happens. There's a whole set of movements in many different fields now that are looking at how do people become more whole, and I think this is part of that.
Well, you brought up the word consciousness. I'm actually working on a project right now with a lot of the people that you know, Dean and Bill Tiller. What is your definition of consciousness?
Well, it's
because I think there's a big language barrier there.
I agree completely. And all of this research is kind of stymied by definitional issues, not just are the words that we use to describe things, but also how do you operationalize, or that's a scientific word, meaning how do you actually measure something?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, we heard a lot of definitions of consciousness from our interviewees, and I don't think we've settled on one, but the kinds of phrases that we heard would be something like the ground of being from which all experience arises.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in common language, people talk about consciousness as what am I aware of?
Right.
But obviously there's a lot going on that we're not aware of. I mean, everyone knows there are things that are kind of below our conscious awareness that also seem to be related to consciousness. So
yep.
I guess another definition might be something like, you know, we know that there is the readily observable physical world. Consciousness is sort of the subjective world. So
mm-hmm.
it's part of us that is the sensor. So if there are all of these things that we're perceiving through our senses, what is it that's sensing all of those things?
Right,
and that
right.
might be consciousness.
We've got to do something about that because how could we, you know, science is never going to take us serious. Because I've been interviewing Dean and Bill and Brenda Dunn and Charles Tart and a whole bunch
yeah.
of people in it. And I put out 20 questions to each one of them about what is your definition of consciousness, what is your definition of mind, and believe it or not, I got 20 different answers.
Yeah, it's so
you know, we can't ever be expected for science to take us seriously if we don't resolve that issue.
Yeah.
Now, another question, we're talking about unconscious. What is your definition of unconscious?
Well, we haven't really looked at unconscious in that sense. I mean, we, you know, as trained as a psychologist, I would just say it's the things that we're not aware of, you know, that are happening, but that we're just not aware of them. And there's
mm-hmm.
lots of, you know, very, very interesting research showing how things that are just beneath our consciousness are things that we're not aware of, what maybe psychoanalytic thinkers would have called the unconscious,
mm-hmm.
Actually have a big impact on how we're behaving. So there's,
right.
for example, there's a test called IAT, which tests for implicit things. And so what will happen is it's kind of back to the days when there was all this talk about subliminal messages. And so someone will tell the researcher someone that they feel very close to and safe with and someone that they don't feel that way with. And the researcher will subliminally flash that name, maybe along with a series of numbers. And what's interesting is if the person has flashed in front of them their safe figure, their memory will actually be better than if they had their unsafe figure subliminally flash in front of them.
Interesting.
So, you know, it's amazing how those kinds of things are affecting us every day. And the other thing I think that's really interesting about this that has to do with transformation and the way that you change in these spiritual epiphanies is the work on inattentional blindness. And so I don't know if you've ever seen the video, but there are exercises in the laboratory that prove that when you're not expecting to see something in your field of vision, you actually don't see it. So there's this great video that everybody should check out. I think the website is vizcog.com, and I'm not going to give up the surprise, but in general, the punchline is, you know, there can be something in your field of vision that if you are attending to something else or if you're expecting something else, you literally do not see it.
There's somebody, I can't remember who it was, but somebody came on my show one day and was talking about something like that, how they were looking at videos of domestic violence and how it would be a woman committing the domestic violence, but the majority of the people who watched this video saw it as being a man.
Yeah, could not see it. Yeah, that's very, it's very similar. And so when you experience that for yourself, and you then you really start to ask yourself, what else am I not seeing in the world? What else is getting cut out of my consciousness because I'm not expecting it or because I'm attending to something else?
A good point. Well, do you believe that this shift affects more than just the individual, but the masses as well, even though it happens in only one person? Let's just say, if one person shifts, does it affect just them, or does it affect the masses?
Well,
and if so, how does it do that?
Our interview respondents had, we asked that question about, you know, how do you think that the individual transformation affects collective transformation, and some of our respondents were very direct about it and said, well, of course, individuals make up groups and groups make up societies, so the more individuals change, the more groups and societies will change. That's sort of the direct level. And then other people really, as I said, like Andrew Cohen and some other teachers, really kind of felt like one person's transformation doesn't just directly affect, because they're part of groups, the evolution of consciousness or the way that the world is changing, but that in sort of a mystical sense, sort of the more people who wake up, that there's sort of a movement happening where the world is waking up or humanity is waking up in this way. So that was the range of responses we got from people, was everything from, well, you know, if you transform, then maybe you start recycling, you start changing your community, one in your own backyard, to this sort of more cosmic level of how people who are changing their own consciousness are contributing to sort of a collective change in consciousness.
Well, you know, David Hawkins, the guy that wrote Power versus Force, he says in his book, and I don't know how he measures this, but maybe you might know, that every major shift like that carries the energy for the negativity of 10,000 people.
Yeah.
Do you have any comments on that?
No idea how he could measure that. I mean, the closest I would come is the work that you're probably very familiar with, which is Dean Radin and Roger Nelson's Global Consciousness Project, where they're looking at these random number generators that are placed throughout the world and seeing the degree to which the numbers kind of depart. They just spit out a stream of random numbers, but at certain points in time, the numbers depart from randomness. And so they look at whether big shifts in global consciousness have an effect on those random number generators, and they're finding some very, very interesting things.
Well, it would seem logical to me. You know, they've said that an electron can be in two places at one time, and it would seem logical to me if somebody had a major shift like that, that it could also affect the opposite side of the world just due to that model. It would seem logical to me anyway. So
I think the other thing that's interesting, I mean, when we use these words, we talk about transformations in consciousness or consciousness changing, and we actually had to change one of our questions because we at first started asking about consciousness transformation, and most of the people we interviewed said, actually, you know, consciousness doesn't transform. Our perspective on consciousness transforms. Our experience of it transforms. So
you suddenly view the world differently.
Yeah, it's a shift.
As in that nothing happens. One second you're one way, and the next second it's another way, and nothing happened.
Yeah.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
So did you find that it affected the way these people live their lives and the quality of their lives?
Well, the people that we interviewed, we asked them about what are some of the most common outcomes of a transformation like this. And again, you know, there's the big transformative moment that can really change your perspective. And for some people who are lucky, it changes their behavior and their relationships in a very long-lasting way. Most people have to do a lot of work to integrate that new perspective and to bring it into their lives. And so it takes, you know, a mind-body practice that someone practices daily, or continuing to receive new information and new teachings, or, you know, really doing some work to having reminders throughout their day and throughout their life that this is this new way that they want to be, because it's so easy to just drift back into the old habit patterns. And so So the people that we interviewed have made this their life. You know, these are people mm-hmm. who are writing and thinking and teaching about it. And what we're really interested in now is talking to people who are engaged in their own transformative practices or who have had transformative experiences. And we're surveying, hopefully, thousands of people about their transformation. And it's an online survey. It's at transformationsurvey.com. And those are the kinds of questions that we're asking, is what really happened for you? You know, because the teachings will, you know, the teachings and the traditions will say, if you do this, this will happen. But there really hasn't been all that much empirical research to find out, does it in fact happen? And so a lot of the outcomes that people said happen are things like decreased reactivity, an ability to take things a lot less personally, an ability to be compassionate and forgiving, to have gratitude, to approach the world with a sense of curiosity and awe and wonder. Their lives became more colorful and rich and deeper and juicier. And
mm-hmm.
you know, most people didn't say that their lives became, quote, easier. You know, they became more of everything that really is. They became more awake and more aware in every moment. And so, you know, what we, again, I mean, this survey that we're doing at transformationsurvey.com is a way that we're trying to find out,
mm-hmm.
okay, this is what the teachers told us. What's real? What's real for people who are out there doing a yoga practice a couple times a week, or people who are even people who are gardening, or people who are parenting, or people who are doing activities in their lives and making their way along this path. What are the real outcomes, and what are the ways in which those outcomes manifest, and what kind of factors will either facilitate those kinds of outcomes or inhibit them?
Did you find that a lot of these people, after they had this experience, felt a unity and understood more of like a non-duality approach to life?
Well, that was a major theme among the experiences that we looked at, was shared, a sense of a shared experience, interconnectedness, unifying field, feeling a part of everything, belonging to everything, feeling fused or one with all that is. So that was definitely a major theme in the experiences, regardless of what tradition people came from.
Because one of the things that I came away with was when I woke up, I understood that we live in a holographic environment, and it made me realize, well, you know what, we're not really here to begin with. It's more like a movie.
Mm.
So what difference does all this stuff matter?
Mm.
It's more like a learning experience. Did you find that with anybody else?
Yeah, I think people mentioned a sort of a, I guess a way of saying it would be a decentering or a depersonalization. In other words, and again, it goes back to, you know, in psychology, these are symptoms that aren't considered so great, to depersonalize or to feel
mm-hmm.
decentered or to feel like your ego is not central. You know, psychologists will talk about a weakened ego. And in this sense, it's just different words, and I think in the end, everyone's kind of moving towards the same wholeness in their theories. But this decentering or depersonalization is kind of what made it easier for people to navigate their lives, because they
mm-hmm.
said, you know, it's not just about me and what I need and what I want. It's about us. We're all here together. We're all sort of, I guess Stan Grof would say, you know, we're in the cosmic game. We're in the play of life. And so
right.
here we are doing all these things, and it just kind of makes everything a lot less agonizing, you know? So people
mm-hmm.
then are able to approach their lives with a little bit more lightness. And one of the great things we found is we asked the question, how do you recognize someone who's been transformed? And
mm-hmm.
I would say one of the most common answers, and this is going to be really tough for a scientist to figure out how to measure, is there's just a light in their eyes. There's just a twinkle.
It's not, yeah, right. It's not the way their eyes look. It's how they look out of their eyes,
exactly.
if that makes any sense.
Yeah, but we all know what we're talking about when we say that, light in their eyes. There's just
mm-hmm.
a light in their eyes. And I think part of that has to do with this understanding of I don't know if I would call it the unreality of things, but you know, it's this thing that we're kind of trying to get at here is that, you know, we're all in this together, and as much as we think all of these things that we used to think mattered so much matter, they're not the most important things. And many, many of our respondents said, you know, after you go through that process, what's left is really just sort of compassion.
That's right.
Just this feeling of how can I serve, how can I help, because
agape,
here we are,
actually.
You know,
mm-hmm.
struggling through this together.
Yeah. So what about the role of intention and free will?
Yeah.
What did they come away saying about that? Did they have a different perspective of that?
Well, I mean, one of our main themes, and I think it's a very interesting paradox, is that we would ask people, you know, what kinds of things do you need to do in order to really support your transformation? And people would say, you know, you really have to surrender. You've got to let things flow through you, let go, you know, kind of the Taoist idea of, you know, go with the flow. And at the very same time, you have to have a strong, determined, and unwavering intention that you intend to be a compassionate, loving, awake, and aware being. And so at the very same time, it's equally true, people said, you know, you have to make the choice every day that this is who you want to be, and at the same time, let go and surrender. And so it's a very interesting thing for language and for our Western way of thinking that we would think, well, you either surrender or you have intention, one or the other. And they're saying both. You have strong intention and you surrender.
That's right. You kind of, I describe it as stepping out, like if you're in an argument, for example, you step out of your body and step back about 3 feet and just observe that thing happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it will change the way you respond to it because you'll actually realize you look like an idiot if you're doing that.
Yeah.
But you can't see it. For some reason, you just can't see that if you
well,
don't.
It's that broadened perspective that you talked about. So,
yeah.
You know, many people are walking through the world, looking out of their eyes, having that feeling that I am the center of this world and I'm looking at everything through these eyes. And when people have this broadening of perspective or this depersonalizing, decentering experience, all of a sudden they have the capacity to kind of take a 360-degree walk around themselves and not only look at situations from a little bit of a broader perspective, but also see themselves from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I lost the train of thought there for a minute. Did you find that people that had these experiences were able to have better health?
Well, I mean, we haven't done the real studies on that yet. I mean, there are a lot of studies that show links between, on one hand, religious affiliation and better health. There are many studies that support that link, and then some that look at spirituality, not as many yet, but they're increasing the number of studies on spirituality and health. There are also some great studies on specific spiritual practices and health, such as meditation or yoga or even expressive writing and things that people do as part of their spiritual path often.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, I don't know if there is a lot of good data on spiritual transformation in health, and so that's an area that needs to be studied more.
What about a lot of people say to me, because a lot of people know what goes on in my life because I try to use my life to teach other people, and I don't have the best marriage in the world, and people say, well, if you're so spiritual or if you're so consciously aware, why don't you have a perfect life? And one of the things that I say to the people, it doesn't mean that life doesn't continue happening.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that we're not still presented with lesson, and it doesn't mean that we're not presented with hardship. What I find is that it's the way I deal with those hardships change.
Yeah, I
think. Do you find that with those people?
Definitely.
I mean,
true.
Just because you have a spiritual experience, it doesn't mean everything becomes perfect, does it?
Absolutely. I mean, we had people who were saying, you know, wow, the way you deal in your relationships really changed. Of course, I'm on my fifth marriage, you know. So
right.
There's some humor about it, you know. It's sort of like, wow, here we all are. And One of the people that we interviewed was Ram Dass, and he's a spiritual teacher that many people are familiar with. And he said, you know, my neuroses are not gone by any means. The only difference is that, I try to give him a direct quote, he said, you know, they'll come in and I'll say, oh, there you are again, you little schmoo, you know.
Yeah.
Pride, greed, jealousy, you know, desire, all these things. He said, they're not gone by any means. The only difference I have now is that I sort of see them and they're
you
a
become
little
bit more aware. We're still human beings, but we become more aware that our behavior is inappropriate and we accept that it's inappropriate.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there are just many different, everyone is kind of on their transformative journey on different paths. I mean, I think there's a kind of development that we have an affinity for and that's easy for us, so we really shoot really far ahead in that realm while we're still struggling in another realm. And
Well, did you have any surprises in this research?
Well, that's a good question. Let me think about surprises. Well, I don't know if I'd call it surprises, but I've talked a lot about the commonalities among people, and I haven't talked a lot about the differences between the traditions. And so one of the interesting differences was that among the traditions, I would say it's about 50-50 that people felt like the role of a teacher or a guru or someone like that in their life was a very, very important influence. So there are about half the people who really hadn't had that experience at all and they didn't feel like they needed it. And another half of the people that, you know, it was a fundamental part of their transformation. And there was one, you know, many great stories about people who met one other person who had this awakeness or had this light in their eyes. And just by meeting that person, it changed their entire life. And then some of them continued an ongoing relationship with that person, either as a personal teacher or as sort of a divine figure. One guy said that he was sitting in his office and he was in the Sufi tradition and somebody walked down the hall, just kind of stopped at his office for a minute and glanced in at him and walked past, and that was the transformative moment that changed this person's life. And he said, I have to know whatever that man knows. And it was just, you know, out of the blue. So I
have a perspective about that.
Yeah.
Did I let you finish your thought?
No, please go ahead.
No, did I let you finish your thought?
Yeah, you did.
Oh, okay. You know, everybody, when you walk into a room and there's an angry person, you know it. You know, that energy affects you. Your electromagnetic field, you feel that person, and I think that's the way you do it. And I think that when somebody, and I'm going to use the word frequency, though I don't think it's the right word. I just don't know the right word. When someone has a frequency that's a lot greater than yours, I believe that field of frequency or energy, electromagnetic field, whatever you want to call it, it has to affect yours. And I think if you're close to the brink of a shift, that it can send you on over.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched it happen with people. And I went through a period of life and time in my life where I felt a teacher was absolutely necessary, but it was because, you know, information comes down and it drops down all in one piece, like when you get an idea. And when you do have one of these shifts and information drops in and you don't know where it came from, and you don't know what it means, and you don't know if it's right or it's wrong, it helps to have a teacher to at least let you know that you're not crazy and to explain some of this stuff. But I believe that you get to a point when the frequency, again, there's that word, when it goes up high enough, like on Hawkins' scale, say 500 or 600, maybe 600, not 500, because 500 is just when you start doing it, but 600 or 700, you don't need that teacher anymore because there's nothing else to teach you.
Mm-hmm.
Because that information, you know, it comes down all at one time, and once you accept what it is and that it is real and you found that everything in the past that's come in has been right, it feels right, or it's been comparable to what other teachers have, then you learn to trust it as being what is.
Mm.
So you don't need that teacher anymore.
Yeah.
At least that's my experience.
Yeah, yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we're about out of time, so I would like to touch 1 minute on your addiction work, because I think that's so important. What have you, or have you found anything in the consciousness study that helps people with addictions like that?
Well, I mean, right now we're in the process of testing. Obviously, we know that for many people, a spiritual transformation was the key determining moment of quitting smoking, quitting drinking, quitting using drugs. And for many people, that was in the context of AA, which is actually just a great example of the whole transformative process and the way that a community and a set of values and, you know, many different elements of the transformative process are built right into AA. And so it, in a way, it provides that perfect preparation, that perfect context and language and support for someone to have a spiritual transformation. But we wanted to find out more about, is there a way that specific spiritual practices might help people deal with cravings or with, you know, most people who relapse, even though they have the best of intentions, and even if they may have had a spiritually transformative experience, they go back to drinking or using or smoking because of a very distressing moment, a really difficult event. And so our idea was maybe we can use some of the, in this case, we're looking at mindfulness practices, mindfulness meditation practices, to help people deal better with their emotional state. And it goes back to exactly what you were saying earlier in the hour about having a witnessing perspective on the emotional state that's happening. So rather than saying, I am so angry, you see people say, I can really see myself getting angry. And it's a subtle distinction, but it makes all the difference in people's capacity to deal with their emotional state, to be able to say, okay, I see I'm getting hot, my temperature's rising, my heart is beating, I'm breathing hard, I'm just going to sit here with that and watch it and be aware of the fact that it actually always comes in, reaches a peak, and goes away. And it's true for cravings, too. You know, you see a craving, and if you're right in the middle of it and you're seeing it as a sense, you know, this is what's happening for me, you know, it can feel like it's not going to end, and you can get this, your brain almost interprets it as an urgent moment, like, I have got to ameliorate this feeling. And, you know, someone might even have the best of intentions and say, as soon as I take care of this, I'll get right back on the wagon.
Right.
You know, so it feels urgent, it feels like survival, it feels like something that has to be taken care of right away. And mindfulness practices were actually developed exactly for this purpose, to say, we know that the human condition has to do with aversion to things we don't want and attachment to things we do want. And this is a process that's been developed over millennia to help people watch their experience and notice that it's temporary, notice that it comes in, it peaks, and then it passes away. And so in a way, it expands people, what we hope anyway, is that it expands people's capacity to hold whatever experience they're having and not take that drink or drug until it passes through, you know. And
yeah.
So that's the idea, and it's a hypothesis. It's not proven, and so we're doing some work to try to test that by teaching people mindfulness practices who have already quit smoking and drinking and see if it helps them curb their cravings, reduce their stress, improve their overall psychological well-being, and reduce relapse.
It will do it if they just ride it out that little bit of time.
Well, and it's a hard question, because I know that one of the things we don't know is who has an affinity for these practices and who might be right for a different experience. I mean, that's one thing that in the spiritual transformation literature, it's very hard to know who will it work for and who won't it work for, because we have the feeling it probably won't work for everyone. So it's just a matter of trying to find, you know, hey, if you're this kind of person with this issue, this practice might actually help you.
I wonder how it would work with people that are going, you know, some alcoholics or drug addicts, when they try to quit, they go through DTs. Wonder how it would work with that.
Hard to know. I mean, those very extreme, intense experiences. I've heard some success stories, you know, with people who have had extreme pain, for example. I mean, I've never witnessed this myself, and I don't know if it's an urban legend, but you've heard of people who go through surgery without anesthesia by using their minds. And
you know,
myself,
sorry.
I I'm someone who practices mindfulness and meditation, and my most extreme moment was probably giving birth to my daughter. And so I like to say, you know, it helped me through the first 36 hours, and then things got a little hairy.
You know, my father actually went through a really traumatic experience of DTs, and I wonder, would they be able to hold that mindfulness, because he kind of got out of his mind, and I don't think he could tap into that.
Yeah, there may be limits. You know, it's really, I think it's probably a, it could be just a direct function of how much you practice. You know?
Yeah, that it would be.
But so, I'm sure there are extreme moments for everyone where, you know.
Well, one more question that I thought about. Did you find that it made any difference what religion someone was, whether they had a spiritual epiphany or not?
Well, I mean, I think that's really where we're coming from. We called our first preliminary paper that came out of this study, we called it Many Paths, One Mountain, because we believe that there is a transformational experience and process that almost all of the religions and spiritual traditions and the modern, more eclectic, transformative movements are pointing to that is really the same process. It's just that it's framed differently, it's languaged differently, it's storied differently.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that we think that everyone goes through the same process, because that's clearly not true, but there probably are common elements of the process, common markers, milestones, triggers, things that we might be able to identify that regardless of what religion or tradition someone comes from, it might be helpful to them.
Yeah. Because I think almost everyone I've ever talked to came from a fundamentalist religion at some point.
Yeah.
And then after this experience, it was just like, it doesn't matter anymore. It's just one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Veetin.
You're
it's
welcome.
It's wonderful
to
find out that this is important work is going on, because
Thanks.
If it tells somebody something, it's really happening, and we aren't crazy.
Yeah, and I'd love for everyone to go to transformationsurvey.com on the Internet and fill out the survey for us. That would be very helpful to the research. And go to the
Institute. Where could they read about what you're doing?
Well, I would send them to the Institute of Noetic Sciences website and go to the research link.
And that's www.ions.org, right?
That's right.
All right, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And agape to you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Good night.